Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 970, Partying Like It's 1932, Part 2, The Japanese Deep State. This is being recorded on August 22nd of the year 2017. The title of the program stems from the May 15th incident. We went into that in our last program. We've also gone into that in several other shows. That was on May 15th, 1932, when Prime Minister Kai Inukai of Japan was assassinated by military cadets from the Blood Brotherhood and the Native Land-Loving School. The former, and to an extent the latter, were outcroppings of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies that helped to bring fascism to Japan through a combination of indoctrination of young people, military cadets in particular, and also through a wave of political assassinations that removed many of their potential opponents and intimidated many of their other opponents as well. In our last program, in addition to analyzing the Native Land-Loving School, we also talked about how the current administration of Shinzo Abe had been supplementing and helping to finance revisionist schools such as Tsukemoto and the Moritomo Gakuin, those basically resonant with the Native Land-Loving School. In the interests of time, I will simply put in links to sort of sum up and illustrate the element of continuity between the Native Land-Loving School and the Blood Brotherhood of the May 15th incident, and also the Moritomo Gakuin and Tsukemoto, reading from Hugh Bias's 1942 text, Government by Assassination. In 1939, Kosaburo Tachibana's admirers enabled him to establish a school. He called it the Native Land-Loving School, or Aikyojuku, A-I-K-Y-O-J-U-K-U. Everybody in Japan with a message to deliver or an axe to grind opens a school. Those schools in the hands of the patriotic societies are at once a method of training young men for strong-arm work and a plausible excuse for extorting contributions from the rich and timid. Again, everybody in Japan with a message to deliver or an axe to grind opens a school. Those schools in the hands of the patriotic societies are at once a method of training young men for strong-arm work and a plausible excuse for extorting contributions from the rich and timid. And again, something of a degree of resonance between the past of 1932 and the present. One of the main points of discussion and analysis of this program concerns globalization and how the American capital that was generated by the industrial boom of the 1920s was reinvested abroad, specifically primarily in Germany and Japan, who then used that investment capital to invest in strategic heavy industry, which they then used to loot Asia and Europe, respectively. At the end of World War II, the cartels that had been involved in this, the monopolistic associations of transnational corporations, coalesced or recoalesced, and the industrial and financial order of the world did not become a new world order, but rather the old world order was reinstituted at the end of World War II. I'm going, in the interests of time, I'm going to simply include a link to the introduction to the anti-fascist books for download section on the SpitfireList.com website. I went into the links between globalization and Japanese and American transnational corporations, the rise of fascism in Japan, the cartel links between the Japanese Zaibatsu, the Japanese family trusts, huge corporations that dominated the Japanese economy, and American transnational corporations in, for the record, 905. In For the Record 905 and In For the Record program 446, among other programs, we went into not only the Japanese deep state, its links to American oligarchs who, as we noted in the book, The Yamato Dynasty, the American oligarchs rescued their Japanese compatriots, much as they had done in Europe. At the foundation of the Japanese deep state is the looted wealth from Asia that was secreted and accumulated and secreted abroad and also to an extent in Japan proper as under the Operation Golden Lily or Golden Lily Project. The definitive book on that is the remarkable text called Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, whom I have interviewed a couple of times, and there are many programs dealing with the Golden Lily dynamic, including For the Record 427, 428, 446, 451, 501, 509, 688, and 689. Again, there will be links in the description for the show, but in the interests of time, we are going to proceed in a forward direction. One of the things to understand, as noted in 446, called funds, F-U-N-D-S, and gains, is that at the core of the reinstitution of fascist elements in Japan and their continued operation not only as an anti-communist bulwark in Japan, in Asia, I should say, but also as continued cartel partners of U.S.-based and other transnational corporations. At the core of this is the monies generated by Operation Golden Lily, or the Golden Lily Project. One of the most important of those funds was the M Fund, or the Marquardt Fund, that had hundreds of millions of dollars in it, and it was derived from Golden Lily loot and also from $100 million in the early 50s or maybe late 40s came from the Kodama Fund, headed up by Yoshio Kodama, about whom we will have more to say later. Yoshio Kodama was the CIA's man in Japan for many years, and like Roichi Sasakawa, about whom we will have more to say later, he was not only a key Japanese fascist in the pre-World War II and World War II periods, but dominant players on the Japanese political and economic landscape in the post-World War II period, and deeply involved with the establishment of the Unification Church of President Sun Myung-moon. I would note here that Taro Aso, was at one point the Japanese prime minister. He is now the finance minister of Japan and the deputy prime minister, is undoubtedly someone who is able to draw on the M Fund for various political activities. In For the Record 969, we took a look at a statement that was given by the head of the Moritomo Gakuin, in which He hinted that dark forces within the finance ministry were involved with the financing of his patriotic/ultranationalist schools like Moritomo Gakuin. That undoubtedly has in sort of in the wings the M Fund. So when we hear about Taro Aso, bear in mind that as finance minister, he would undoubtedly be in the position to mobilize M Fund and Golden Lily loot on behalf of his political agenda. As we will see, the Aso Mining Company, his family's business, not only used allied prisoners of war as slaves in the post-World War II period, but it was involved with mining. I think there is an excellent chance that the Aso Mining Company, coal mining company, was involved with the creation of some of the underground storage areas for Golden Lily loot. And again, due to the limitations of time, the written description for the Record 970 will necessarily have to suffice to flesh out many of these connections. Looming large also in the foreground and background of the events we have been discussing and in connection with the Japanese deep state is the Nippon Kagai, or Kaigi as it was translated in the GermanForeignPolicy.com. That translates Japan Conference. 289 of the 722 members of the Diet, D-I-E-T, the Japanese Parliament. 13 of 19 of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ministers are involved with that. So is Shinzo Abe. So are many powerful Japanese economic figures, such as Toshio Matoya, a billionaire Japanese hotelier who has, among other things, stocked his APA hotels and motels with ultra-right-wing literature. There is, again, a summation of the Japan Conference in the written description for the Record 970. We went into that at considerable length in For the Record 969. About Toshio Matoya and his sponsorship of an essay contest, which was won by the former chief of staff of the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force, Toshio, T-O-S-H-I-O, T-A-M-O-G-A-M-I, from the New York Times of January 20th of 2017, an article by Jonathan Sobel, S-O-B-L-E. Right-wing hoteliers in Japan anger China with their revisionist views. Skipping down. One piece of literature that was featured for years was an essay by a former Air Force General, Toshio Tamagami, the former chief of staff of the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force and a member of Nippon Kagai, which won a prize in an APA-sponsored contest in 2008. In it, Mr. Tamagami claimed that Japan had been duped into attacking the U.S. at Pearl Harbor in 1941 in a plot he said was hatched by communists inside the administration of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. And noting that, there is an article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer of January 11th of 2009. This is by Bill Meyer. Japanese justifying of World War II history stirs debate. And this goes into the essay by Mr. Tamagami. And again, the essay is skipping down. Tamagami called his essay was Japan an aggressor nation and wrote that Japan has been unjustly subjugated to, quote, the history of the victor. Skipping down, former Trade Minister Takeo Hiranuma praised Tamagami for his frankness. What Mr. Tamagami said was true, he said in a video message on his website. We should take this opportunity to study harder so we can have correct views of Japan's history. There are many people, including political leaders, who support Tamagami's views, said historian Hisao Ishiyama, quote, "It's not a problem of one fanatic military official," unquote. Tamagami's views are common among nationalists, including former Prime Minister, and I would add this is 2009, current Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who with a strong segment of the ruling party behind him, spearheaded a partially successful campaign over several years to remove mention of Japan's wartime atrocities from textbooks. Only in recent years, after lawsuits from victims, has Japan acknowledged many of its brutalities, including the use of poison gas in China and sex slaves recruited in countries under wartime occupation. Prime Minister Azo himself, he was Prime Minister at that time, he is now the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, and again, in that position, able to mobilize M Fund and other Golden Lily loot on behalf of the reinstitution of Japanese, or really not the reinstitution, but the entrenchment of Japanese, the further entrenchment of Japanese fascism and the fundamental revision of Japanese history. Now note, as we looked at in For the Record program number 813 and in 969, among others, Taro Azo is among several members of Shinzo Abe's cabinet who is an exponent of the political methodology of Adolf Hitler, which he feels can be used to sneak constitutional changes past the Japanese people. More about that later.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
And Azo here, again, finance minister, former prime minister, and current deputy prime minister, skipping down in the Cleveland Plain Dealer article from 1/11/2009. Azo himself has had to admit to Parliament for the first time that his family-run company, Azo Coal Mining, used hundreds of Allied war prisoners at its mines in the final months of the war. He offered no apology. Several things in connection with that. Again, I think there is an excellent chance that this mining operation from his family was involved in the projects that were used to stash Golden Lily loot underground during the war, particularly during the closing months. Something to bear in mind, too, is the fact that there was a lawsuit that former Allied POWs in Japan brought against the Zaibatsu, the giant Japanese corporations that were involved with using slave labor in their operations in World War II. That was dismissed. Sumitomo Mitsui Mitsubishi, or Mitsubishi rather, and there is one other, Sumitomo Mitsui, Mitsubishi, and one other Zaibatsu were targets of that lawsuit. As we shall see, the U.S. diplomats who helped to not only shunt aside that lawsuit, but characterize, and again, we're talking about former Allied POWs, including American service personnel who were captured by the Japanese and used as slave laborers. They were officially branded terrorists by these U.S. diplomats who themselves have profound connections to the milieu of the Zaibatsu. So again, note that Taro Azo, former PM, current finance minister, undoubtedly able to draw on the billions of dollars, the vast nation-buying sums that were secreted under the Golden Lily program, and himself an advocate of the political methodology of Adolf Hitler, which he feels can successfully sneak constitutional changes past the Japanese public. His family had a mining operation that used Allied POWs. Now back to Toshio Tamagami himself, a member of the Japan Conference or Nippon Kagai. From his Wikipedia entry, at a semi-political meeting on the 15th of September of 2004, Tamagami said that he felt that it would probably be necessary for Japan to develop nuclear arms in order to be seen as an independent nation by China, and that promising never to develop nuclear arms is, quote, foolish, unquote. After the furor created by his essay and dismissal, he was asked by a British journalist on December 1, 2008, whether he would have used nuclear arms against America in 1945. He responded that, quote, he might have considered using nuclear weapons against the U.S. Tamagami claimed that other members of the Japanese government and military share his views. And in yet another example of standing World War II history on its head, the essay also argues that the war brought prosperity to occupied China, Taiwan, and Korea, that, quote, it is often those who never directly saw the Japanese military who are spreading rumors about the army's act of brutality, unquote, and that the Greater East Asia War is viewed in a positive way by many Asian countries. Well, that not only were China, Taiwan, and Korea looted systematically by the Japanese, among other countries under the Golden Lily program, but in fact, the memories of the brutal occupation under the Japanese Imperial Army is one of the things, one of the sore points for the increase in tensions in Asia, China. And both North and South Korea are bridling at this. We don't hear much about the distress this has caused in South Korea. Holding a brief for Mr. Jong-un of North Korea, consider this, and many wags have noticed this, having an unstable political leader with a funny-looking haircut who routinely threatens apocalyptic military violence. Aren't you glad we don't have someone like that here in the U.S.? But it is a pretty good bet that Mr. Jong-un, for all of his idiosyncrasies, is aware of the history of this. And beyond that, I think it is altogether probable that intelligence services around the world, including North Korea, is aware of what else I am going to talk about here. Now, again, we're hearing all about Chinese military adventurism in Asia, and right now the world is facing something of a rhetorical game of chicken between Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-Trump, and the North Korean rocket program, which, by the way, received assistance from Ukraine, from a factory that was under the control of the OUND fascists in Ukraine, who, by the way, have done what the Japanese establishment, or many aspects of it, including the Nippon Kagai and Mr. Tamagami, or former General Tamagami, have urged, which is standing World War II history on its head. It is now a crime in Ukraine to tell the truth about the history of World War II in Ukraine. Note that Tamagami, in addition to blaming World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and communists in his administration who lured Japan into attacking Pearl Harbor, he also advocates nuclear weapons and their development by Japan. And that is something that apparently has, in fact, been underway since the 1960s. There has apparently been a clandestine nuclear weapons program in Japan using peaceful nuclear facilities such as reactors and also supposedly peaceful space exploration to develop nuclear weapons and hide that from the Japanese people. Much the way Taro Aso has advocated using Hitler's political methodology to slip constitutional changes past the Japanese public. revealing something we looked at in For the Record 813 from the D.C. Bureau of April 9th of 2012, an article by Joseph Trento, T-R-E-N-T-O. United States circumvented laws to help Japan accumulate tons of plutonium. The United States deliberately allowed Japan access to the United States' most secret nuclear weapons facilities while it transferred tens of billions of dollars worth of American tax-paid research that has allowed Japan to amass 70 tons of weapons-grade plutonium since the 1980s, a National Security News Service investigation reveals. These activities repeatedly violated U.S. laws regarding controls of sensitive nuclear materials that could be diverted to weapons programs in Japan. The National Security News Service investigation found that the United States has known about a secret nuclear weapons program in Japan since the 1960s, according to CIA reports. The diversion of U.S. classified technology began during the Reagan administration after it allowed a $10 billion reactor sale to China. Japan protested that sensitive technology was being sold to a potential nuclear adversary. The Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations permitted sensitive technology and nuclear materials to be transferred to Japan despite laws and treaty preventing such transfers. And again, repeating a sentence from the previous paragraph, the National Security News Service investigation found that the U.S. has known about a secret nuclear weapons program in Japan since the 1960s. Continuing with the next paragraph, highly sensitive technology on plutonium separation from the U.S. Department of Energy's Savannah River site and Hanford Nuclear Weapons Complex, as well as tens of billions of dollars worth of breeder reactor research, was turned over to Japan with almost no safeguards against proliferation. Japanese scientists and technicians were given access to both Hanford and Savannah River as part of the transfer process. While Japan has refrained from deploying nuclear weapons and remains under an umbrella of U.S. nuclear protection, MSNS has learned that the country has used its electrical utility companies as a cover to allow the country to amass enough nuclear weapons materials to build a nuclear arsenal larger than China, India, and Pakistan combined. The secret effort was hidden in a nuclear power program that by March 11, 2011, the day the earthquake and tsunami overwhelmed the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, had amassed 70 metric tons of plutonium. Like its use of civilian nuclear power to hide a secret bomb program, Japan used peaceful space exploration as a cover for developing sophisticated nuclear weapons delivery systems. Political leaders in Japan understood that the only way the Japanese people could be convinced to allow nuclear power into their lives was if a long line of governments and industry hid any military application. For that reason, a succession of Japanese governments colluded on a bomb program disguised as innocent energy and civil space programs. And again, we're not hearing anything about this. One wonders how much this has to do with some of the, certainly the bluster of Kim Jong-un. And I can't say his idiosyncrasies aside. I think if I were the head of state of any country in Asia, and bear in mind that Korea, all of it, there was no North and South, was a Japanese colony from 1905 to 1945. I think that a clandestine Japanese nuclear weapons program, which has apparently been going on since the 1960s, is something that would give me pause to think and, frankly, cause alarm.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Something that not only inspired some sad recognition, but which frankly made me feel kind of old. Someone who has been something of a go-to guy for, among other outlets, the New York Times on anything having to do with Japanese security matters and military matters, and somebody who has also almost always said, "Well, yeah, this is a change, but it really isn't something we need to worry about," is a guy named Jeffrey, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y, Horning, H-O-R-N-U-N-G. Among the articles quoting him was an article in the New York Times of February 3rd of 2017. Jim Mattis says U.S. is shoulder to shoulder with Japan by Michael R. Gordon and Motoko Rich, M-O-T-O-K-O, last name R-I-C-H. And it quotes Jeffrey Horning about the meeting between Mattis and Abe, which Mattis said, "You know, we're right with you. Don't worry. We're not going to let North Korea or China push you around." "It's sad that we've even come to this point," said Jeffrey Horning, a fellow in the Security and Foreign Affairs Program at Sasakawa Peace Foundation, USA, a research institute based in Washington. That is named after and was begun with a donation from Roichi Sasakawa, one of the most prominent in the Japanese fascist constellation, so one could say, a man who bragged that he was the world's richest fascist, someone with very strong links to the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies, someone with very close links to the Mitsubishi Company, one of the Japanese zaibatsu, and the largest military contractor, the largest element, largest company in Japanese national security industry. He also was very close to Yoshio Kadama, and Yoshio Kadama and Ryuichi Sasakawa deeply involved with not only the patriotic societies, but the golden, well, in Kadama's case, the looting of the Japanese underworld. Both also helped to finance the Unification Church. We're going to jump back to December 8th, 1991, and access a portion of an interview that was recorded on that date with Daniel Junas, J-U-N-A-S, about Sasakawa, Kadama, Mitsubishi, the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies, and the Unification Church.
Now, Dan, we have just been talking about the Unification Church, and specifically we've been talking about some of the connections between the Unification Church and Japanese fascism, specifically Roichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kadama. Of course, we have been commemorating here in this country the attack on Pearl Harbor, and I wonder if you could talk about some of the Japanese fascist connections to the Unification Church and perhaps place that in a context which would be relevant for the listening audience.
Well, Pearl Harbor Day is a pretty good place to start. On the day that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, Yoshio Kadama formed an organization known as the Kadama Agency, which was a purchasing agent for the Naval Air Wing. And Admiral Yamamoto, as many of your listeners may know, was the great champion of air power, of naval air power in Japan.
Also the fellow who commanded the fleet that attacked Pearl Harbor.
Right, and the architect of the attack on Pearl Harbor. But he faced a very serious problem, with the outbreak of war. There were very fierce inter-service rivalries in Japan and competition for raw materials, the strategic materials that they needed. And what the different services would do is they had an intelligence apparatus. They worked with these ultra-nationalist or secret societies who would provide them kind of intelligence services, and they would, you know, they had networks strung out all through throughout the Pacific and Southeast Asia. Now, Yamamoto's problem was that he, one of his problems was that he really didn't have very many friends on the right wing. And one of the reasons for that is Yamamoto thought it was a really pretty bad idea to get into a war with the United States. He had been to the United States. There's a very famous quote, which I will have to paraphrase, about, you know, anyone who has seen the oil fields of Texas and the auto plants of Detroit knows that, you know, we do not have the industrial power to win a war with the United States. But Yamamoto did have one very important friend on the right, and that was Ryoichi Sasakawa. Sasakawa was a very prominent fascist organizer in the 1930s, organized many of these ultranationalist societies.
Now, are we talking about the patriotic societies?
Patriotic societies, yes. And the patriotic societies had their beginnings went back to the late 19th century, to when Japan modernized. They were kind of the successor to the samurai. After the Meiji Restoration, the samurai were declassed, and so some of them began forming these ultranationalist societies. Sasakawa represented a younger generation of a leader of an ultranationalist society, and he was fascinated by the new technology of the airplane. And so he sort of was a more modern version of the ultranationalist. And he had a private militia and a fleet of airplanes. And in fact, in 1939, Sasakawa had flown one of his own planes to Italy to meet with Mussolini and to help arrange the Axis alliance.
In fact, Sasakawa has described Mussolini as his idol and has referred to himself as the world's richest fascist.
That's right. Yes, I think he referred to Mussolini at one point as the perfect fascist. And in this private militia that Sasakawa had, he had his own followers wear black shirts to emulate the black shirts of Mussolini. Well, we also know that 10 months before war broke out, Sasakawa was touring the South Pacific in a flying boat, and he wrote to Admiral Yamamoto. It's one of the ways that we know a little bit about this relationship that Yamamoto had. Now, by one account, it was Sasakawa who asked Kodama to form this purchasing agency, basically, and Kodama looted China and Southeast Asia of strategic materials and gold and, you know, all kinds of valuables that were necessary for the naval air wing needed, but in the process he also enriched himself.
Now, Kodama founded this particular agency or front, which was used as a purchasing arm for the Japanese naval air wing on December 7th, 1941?
That's right. It was formed actually in Japan. The date was December 8th because of the international dateline. But that was the founding date for the Kodama Agency. It was the same day that just as the Japanese were attacking Pearl Harbor, he formed this agency.
And this, of course, was being used to finance the Japanese naval air arm, which was in action over Pearl Harbor at that
time.
Well,
yeah. I mean, I don't know if I would go that far. I mean, it was certainly procuring strategic materials at the naval air wing, and it was also making Kodama a very rich man in the process. Mm-hmm. He was able to hoard a great deal of the wealth that he looted from China and from these Southeast Asian nations. The East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, as the Japanese called it.
Right.
And after the war, he was able to use that hoard to finance his rise in post-war Japan. He became a very important power broker, what the Japanese call a kurumaku,
right.
Which is literally means black curtain. It comes from kabuki theater, and it's the behind-the-scenes fixer. The man who pulls the wires behind the stage.
We have just heard a description from Jim Hogan's book, Spooks, talking about Sasakawa and Kodama, and that specific term was used.
Right, and that is where, so Kodama had a great deal of money, and he formed an alliance with U.S. intelligence and began undertaking assignments for G2, the military intelligence arm, and By 1958, Kodama was on the CIA payroll. And also in 1958, Kodama began his fateful relationship with the Lockheed Corporation, helping Lockheed sell their aircraft in Japan. And in the 1970s, Kodama was implicated in the Lockheed scandal, in which he was helping Lockheed to pay off Japanese politicians in Japan. You know, very big scandal, as many of you will recall. Now, one of the things that's interesting here is that the Kodama and Sasakawa had a very large stake still in the what they called the co-prosperity sphere during the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War was actually very beneficial for the Japanese armaments industry and also for consumer industries, and it provided because the Japanese were kind of a strategic partner of the United States in East Asia. And the war was extremely beneficial to their economy. It really sort of, that was the stimulus that launched the Japanese economy to its sort of, you know, super economic power status today. Again, there's an interesting connection here with the air war. You go back to Sasakawa and Kodama and air power, and here was the United States fighting an air war once again in Southeast Asia.
It's also interesting, Dan, if I could interrupt for just a
sure.
second, that one of the other people involved, along with Kodama in the Lockheed scandal, was General Minoru Genda, who had actually planned the air attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, very interesting connection. And you see that what you see is that there's really kind of a through line here. You know, we tend to think that, well, you know, the United States defeated Japan, and then Japan became a democracy, and there was this break with Japan's militaristic past. But in reality, some of these figures survived and profited from the U.S.-Japan alliance and have been championing the rearmament of Japan.
And also, of course, have been involved with the Unification Church, which is the subject of your forthcoming book.
Right. Now, this is where, you know, this is why one of the reasons I'm making the point about the Vietnam War, the Moon actually had missionaries in the United States beginning in 1959. But they actually, and they had a very small following in the United States. By 1969, there maybe were 120 to 150 converts in the United States. But in 1969, that is when the Unification Church began doing, explicitly doing political work in the United States. And what they were doing was organizing protests to support the war in Vietnam. This was an era not long after Nixon took office, and there were these large protests against the Vietnam War. And the Unification Church began taking the pro side of the Vietnam War, and then later went on to become a supporter of Richard Nixon's during Watergate and so forth. And has, you know, until the 1980s, has accumulated a great deal of power. But this also gets us back to the ultranationalist societies, because the Moon Organization, here they were operating in the United States, and their organizational model is essentially the same as these secret societies that were operating in Japan in the 1930s.
Now, what you're saying is that in your opinion, because this is a working hypothesis that I had advanced and that the listening audience has heard,
mm-hmm.
is that not only are there direct connecting links between the Japanese patriotic societies and the Unification Church, but that the Unification Church could actually be thought of as an analog or perhaps even an extension of the patriotic societies.
Well, yeah, there's a very important article. There's a historian of the modernization of Japan named E.H. Norman, and he wrote a study of the Dark Ocean Society, which was the prototypical ultranationalist society. And I had been studying the Unification Church for some time when I came across this article, and the parallels were really striking. The typical ultranationalist society was a small, tightly knit cadre revolving around a father figure. And it's important here to contrast it, too, with European-style fascism, you know, Mussolini or Hitler-style fascism, where there was an effort to build a mass party, and you had a large number of followers. In this Japanese model of fascism, the ultra-nationalist society is a tightly knit cadre that makes alliances with various powerful institutions, the bureaucracy, the military, and the large corporations, which benefited from Japanese imperialism. It was sort of the glue. E.H. Norman described it as the glue that held together the edifice of Japanese aggression.
Now, where can people get a hold of this E.H. Norman? Is it a book or is it an article?
It is an article, and I don't have a reference right in front of me, but it was published in a magazine called the Pacific Affairs, I believe is the name of it. And there was an organization in the 30s and 40s called the Institute for Pacific Relations. And you can find an excerpt in it, actually, collection edited by called Imperial Japan 1800 to 1945, the Japan Reader, edited by John Livingston, Joe Moore, and Felicia Oldfather, and that's a very useful. It has excerpts from that article and several other useful articles. Anyway, to get back to this, what we find by the 1980s. A lot of Moon's strategy becomes a lot clearer to us in the various kinds of organizations that they're involved in. And we see the same pattern. You have this cadre that is operating through various front organizations that's involved in different kinds of activities. And they have one organization which has military scholars and retired military men and involves itself with military affairs. They have another front organization which is reaching out to large multinational corporations. They have other organizations which are involved in the electoral politics and the political system. So that even though Moon does not have a large number of followers, he doesn't have millions of converts or even hundreds of thousands of followers like Hitler had in his brown shirts. With this cadre, he's been able to sort of build this structure, which reaches into very many different, parts of our society and societies all over the world.
He certainly has a lot of money too.
Well, that's always been the $64,000 question with Moon, is where does the money come from? And for a while they wanted you to believe that they raised it by having his followers sell flowers on the streets. Now, that is pretty lucrative. I mean, they work pretty hard and they do raise an awful lot of money. But nowadays Moon is spending $1 billion building an auto plant in the People's Republic of China, just to pick one, the largest project I can think of. And I just really have a hard time believing that they're raising all that money to build an auto plant by selling flowers. I mean, if that were possible, I think General Motors might have stumbled on it already. And I have come to the conclusion, it's kind of a complicated, body of evidence that you have to look at, but I've really come to the conclusion that the most plausible explanation is that Moon is being funded by Japanese corporations, just as the old ultranationalist societies receive their funding from corporations. And the one corporation that I'm most interested in is Mitsubishi. Particularly Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, which is the Japan's largest arms manufacturer.
Mitsubishi also was one of the four so-called zaibatsu, the giant family trusts, which were instrumental in helping to bring fascism to Japan in the 30s and 40s.
Right, and Mitsubishi in particular was always very much involved with government contracts and military spending. They were much more dependent on that kind of business than, say, the Mitsui family, which was a very old business family. Mitsubishi grew up with the modern Japanese state, was always very much involved in armaments. And it was Mitsubishi, of course, that produced the Japanese Zero, very famous aircraft from World War II.
Also very much involved with Pearl Harbor.
Right, and very much involved with Pearl Harbor. And this was, I mean, and going back to Admiral Yamamoto here, Yamamoto was very much concerned with the production timetable at the, he used to visit the Mitsubishi factory, and he was always concerned about bottlenecks in production. And this, you know, once again brings us to Sasakawa and Kodama and the whole procurement of materials, because this was obviously something that was very important for the Mitsubishi factories to have all the necessary metals and rubber and so forth that they needed to manufacture these airplanes. Now we jump, again, going back to the Moon Organization and jumping several decades ahead in time. We find this corporate outreach arm that I've mentioned is called the Global Economic Action Institute, and we find that Mitsubishi Heavy Industries is one of the corporate sponsors of that. And today, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries is far and away the largest defense contractor in Japan, so that when the Moon Organization takes a stand in Japan in favor of the rearmament of Japan, or when or they have taken a stand in the United States in favor of a defense buildup, which tends to rationalize a defense buildup in Japan as well, since the two countries are allied, this pro-military line that the Moon Organization takes benefits the Mitsubishi Corporation. I mean, there's a remarkable coincidence of interest here, we might say. And while that does not constitute proof that Mitsubishi is funding the Moon Organization, you'd have to say that you'd be surprised if they weren't. I mean, there's just because there is that coincidence of interest. And, you know, there's kind of a through line here. I mean, Mitsubishi was a very big shipbuilding company. Mm-hmm. Their shipbuilding business has fallen off. And that was something that Sasakawa was very much interested in promoting. He had a charitable organization called the Japan Shipbuilding Industry Foundation. So we can kind of sort of look at Sasakawa's career at different points in history and see the same coincidence of interest between Sasakawa and the organizations that he has sponsored and the Mitsubishi Corporation.
Fascinating. Now, very quickly, Dan, can you tell us anything about the role of some of the moon-owned businesses? For example, this evening I have already alluded to, and we'll be talking about again, Paragon House Publishers. I know that for a while the Moon Organization virtually dominated. I don't know if they still do, the Gloucester, Massachusetts fishing industry. To what extent do some of these moon industries, such as Tong Il and others, contribute to the moon financial empire?
Well, what's interesting is that the financial analysts say that these businesses tend to be money losers, mm-hmm. not profit makers. And in fact, one of the big mysteries is where do they get their capital? Because there seems to be this, especially with the Korean businesses, there's this constant infusion of capital, and they're not really making any money, and no one really understands. And although sometimes people say, well, you know, that's how Moon funds the Washington Times. He's losing $30 or $35 million a year at the Washington Times. It's supposedly coming from these Korean businesses. Well, they're losing money. So also I think the newspapers are being subsidized. I would conjecture that the publishing businesses like Paragon House are also being subsidized. And are really more, you know, with Paragon House, like the Washington Times, is part of an effort to influence public opinion, or, you know, to influence the world of ideas through publishing books. Mm-hmm. Paragon House is linked to Moon's scholarly operations, out, you know, reaching out to scholars.
Mm-hmm.
The fishing industry, that's also been projected by some as being a money loser or not particularly profitable. Although they have provided some pretty serious competition. I know that there's been a lot of concern in the fishing industry that, of being undercut by the moon fishing businesses. That, incidentally, too, is the fishing business, going back to the ultranationalist societies, the fishing business is a very common cover for ultranationalist activity. So it's another example where the moon organization is following the pattern that the ultranationalist societies set in the early part of the century.
All righty. I do one more quick question, Dan. Actually, we could probably go on for a considerable period of time. The Japanese wing of the Unification Church is heavily involved with, in fact, virtually represents Japan in the World Anti-Communist League.
That's right.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, that was the World Anti-Communist League, as some of your listeners may know, was originally sponsored primarily by Taiwan and also South Korea, but when the World Anti-Communist League was founded in 1967, Moon and Sasakawa and Kadama and other leaders on the Japanese right were instrumental in establishing the league, the Japanese League chapter. And to this day, that, you know, the Japanese chapter is essentially controlled by the Moon organization and has been a very, the World Anti-Communist League, which has a new name now. I think it's called the World League for Freedom and Democracy.
A misnomer if ever there was one.
Yeah, well, with the collapse of communism, I think they decided they needed a new image. But in any case, that has been kind of a meeting ground for the international right wing. So it's been a very important place for the Moon organization to do business with other fascists and hardline anti-communists.
It should be noted what the very last sentence in the broadcast that I did in February of 86 was, I speculated that the Moon organization basically represented an extension of the Japanese Patriotic Society's functioning in the United States in conjunction with it.
Right. Well, you were on the mark, I would say.
That began an interview with Daniel Junis on December 8th, 1991. In the written description for the program, not something I'm going to read because we are limited for time, there is an excerpt of an article from the British anti-fascist magazine Searchlight from January of 2001, an article by Kenny Coyle, C-O-Y-L-E, Japanese Nationalism Revives, and it goes into the links between Yoshio Kadama, the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies, and Roichi Sasakawa and his links to Mitsubishi and to Kadama, and also both of their links to the Unification Church and the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, which was the Asian element of the former World Anti-Communist League. And you heard Daniel Junis talk about that. Turning briefly to an excerpt from Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. We've been talking about Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. His father was the former was a key member of the Japanese, actually his grandfather, I should say, a key member of the Japanese wartime establishment. It talks about the fact that Kishi had been, skipping down, this was the same Kishi who had been a member of the hardcore ruling clique in Manchuria, with General Tojo Hideki and Hishino Naoki head of the narcotics monopoly. Kishi had also signed Japan's declaration of war against America in December of 1941. During World War II, he was Vice Minister of Munitions and Minister of Commerce and Industry, actively involved in slave labor. Along the way, he made a personal fortune in side deals with the Zaibatsu. Following Japan's surrender, he was one of the most prominent indicted war criminals at Sugamo Prison, where he was a cellmate of Yoshio Kadama. In 1948, when his release from prison was purchased by Kadama, Kishi began organizing the financial base of the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, using Kodama's black gold and injections of M Fund cash. And concluding a discussion of the Japanese deep state, note the use of slave labor by many of the Zaibatsu, again from Gold Warriors, talking about a lawsuit that was filed against the Zaibatsu by former American POWs used as slave laborers. The real issue is conflict of interest. During the Clinton administration, U.S. Ambassador to Japan Thomas Foley was adamant in rejecting compensation for POWs and other slave laborers, insisting that, quote, the peace treaty put aside all claims against Japan. His deputy chief of mission, Christopher J. LaFleur, L-A-F-L-E-U-R, echoed this dogma at every opportunity. It was a matter of some interest to victims that Foley's wife was a well-paid consultant to Sumitomo, one of Japan's biggest Zaibatsu conglomerates, heavily involved in wartime slave labor and a target of the lawsuits. The moment Foley ended his tenure as ambassador and returned to America, he signed on as a paid advisor and lobbyist to another huge conglomerate, Mitsubishi, one of the biggest wartime users of slave labor. Of greater significance, perhaps, is that LaFleur was married to the daughter of former Prime Minister and Finance Minister Miyazawa, one of the three Japanese who secretly negotiated the 1951 treaty and who was also considered to be the financial overseer of the M Fund. So again, the Japanese deep state inextricably linked with the old patriotic and ultranational societies, the giant Zaibatsu, and the American oligarchs and the American-based transnational corporations that helped to sustain the international cartel system in what has become known as, although not particularly well identified as, globalization. Again, for the record, 905 goes into that. I recommend 446, among other shows, for background on Golden Lily and Gold Warriors. This concludes For the Record program number 970, Partying Like It's 1932, Part 2, The Japanese Deep State. This is being recorded on August 22nd of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.